The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
Yes, Dublin aren't in great form, but they're bored out in their mind. Paul Mannion and Jack McCaffrey aren't playing, yes, because of the stress and the strain, but they're a bit bored.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
I'm delighted to welcome Professor Ross Tucker, who you'll know from a multitude of different things, including the Real Science of Sport podcast, which is absolutely worth your time. It's absolutely brilliant. Is with us. Ross, great to talk to you. How are you keeping?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you guys? It's been a long time since we spoke, so I'm glad to be back on.
A long time. Let's get into everything that we've missed, from the Tour de France to the Olympics to all the... No, we won't. We'll just focus on the Olympic Games and just the last couple of days, if that's all right. Let's start with this fast track, Ross. Have fast tracks not always been a thing, and have people not always spoken about fast tracks?
Yes, I remember when I was still a kid watching the Olympics in Atlanta. They spoke about the track being built for the sprinters because they want world records on the big stage. And the distance runners used to complain because they were so hard, basically like slabs of concrete. What seems to be different, and I mean, maybe this is just that I haven't seen it in the past, is that the conversation now, they're talking about this one being more like a trampoline. I've seen a few athletes say that it's more trampoline-like. One of them said it's like running on air, and the distance athletes haven't complained. So it feels to me like the evolution of the material that goes into making the track has changed. So where before fast meant hard, now fast means elastic and bouncy. And so, not unlike what's happened to shoes, the evolution has been in how cushioned but springy can you make the ground? And that seems to be the difference here. So it whether it's just marketing or real, I don't know. It feels real to me.
Yeah, because that's kind of like the key question here. Is this, like, just to give people the quotes from the track designer, he said that the track is very thin, 14 millimetres, but we have added a new element, these rubber granules. He said in the lower layer of the track is this hexagonal design that creates these small pockets of air that not only provide shock absorption, but give some energy return at the same time, a trampoline effect. But can you not have too much of a trampoline effect, Ross? Is this essentially one of the reasons why we're seeing the hurdlers in particular having a particular good time of it?
Yeah, it could be. Just incidentally, what you read there would not be out of place in the marketing materials for a running shoe. So they are very much the same because, you know, and it was probably about 5 or 6 years ago that they started to take these new rubberized materials and put them into midsoles, and it's inevitably found its way into the ground. I spoke with an elite coach the other day. I asked him for his thoughts on it, and he said something interesting, is that when you walk on it, you can already feel that there's something different. But he said some athletes feel that and others don't. So it might be that there's something related to the mechanics where when you're trying to sprint, the objective is you have to apply as much force to the ground as possible. And that force is obviously either vertical and then horizontal. I wonder whether some athletes that apply more vertical force might get more joy from the surface than others. And maybe hurdlers get so much because they're actually jumping 10 times a race. And it helps keep keeps the stride pattern appropriate, especially in the 400, because as you might know, that's the big challenge in the last 150 meters is actually reaching the next hurdle. And that seems to be offset by the bounciness of the surface. Incidentally, if you make it too trampoline-like, then it becomes negative because then the athlete like sinks into it and loses all the energy. So it has to be very stiff but bouncy. So that's a tricky balance. It seems they found it though.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. And from what you're saying there, it seems to me that the reaction to this could be maybe a focus on technique with that specific surface to ensure that you are getting as big a benefit as possible off that surface.
Yeah, possibly. Although the coach, because I asked him, does it make a difference on the contact time with the ground? Does it make a difference to the stride length by propelling the athlete forward? And he says he actually doesn't know. So
right.
I'm not sure they know enough to leverage it into some sort of deliberate advantage. I think everyone's just enjoying the speed that it gives them.
On the shoes then, I'm interested in why Carsten Warholm is not a hypocrite here, because after his 400 metre hurdles, he spoke about Rye Benjamin spikes and obviously Nike Super spikes, who we've spoken about quite a bit on the show. He called them BS. He said he has those things in his shoes, which I hate. And then talking about his own shoes, which he made in conjunction with Mercedes and Puma, he says, we have the carbon plate. We have tried to make it as thin as possible because that is the way I would like to do it. Of course, technology will always be there, but I also want to keep it down to a level where we can compare results, because that is important. Like, I guess we got to take Warholm's word for it to a certain degree, but why are his shoes more acceptable than Rye Benjamin spikes?
Beats me. I saw the same quote and I wondered that when I saw that they developed it with McLaren. And I think it depends on what you think is making the difference in the shoe, you know, because track spikes have always had a stiff carbon plate in them, but we've never seen those carbon fiber plates or the integration of the carbon fiber with the midsole, the elastic midsole material, produce results like we have now. So Warholm's obviously of the school of thought that it's the midsole, because that's the Nike spike, is called the Viperfly. I don't know if you've seen pictures of it. It's got this sort of spring-mounted thing under the forefoot, which looks ridiculous, and which Nike claim compresses, much like you read about the track. It compresses, stores energy, and then releases it back. He doesn't have that, so he obviously believes that's the difference. I would argue that the curvature of the carbon plate is probably making the difference, together with the thickness of the midsole. So, yeah, he's not running in 2018 shoes when he runs that world record, so he knows that it makes a difference to him as well.
Speaking on those world records, is it unfair to athletes that have gone before? You know, we heard Usain Bolt that he said basically that if the shoes start to get too fast, then that's unfair, that you have a problem if the equipment starts to make that leap faster than they actually are. You know, that's what we don't want to see.
Yeah, I'm a purist. Some would say that means old-fashioned in that sense, but for me, the value in athletics is the ease with which we can compare one generation to the previous one. Times mean something, and I think the shoes have distorted that meaning. So we can't say for sure that athlete A is half a second faster than athlete B, because we know that half that half a second might be a contribution of the shoes and the other half might be the track. So it destabilizes our ability to assess performances. I suppose, on the other hand, you'd say an athlete who's retired doesn't really have a right to fairness. I mean, Usain Bolt watching the Olympics on his couch is basically looking after his own legacy, and that's eventually going to change anyway. Records will be broken, whether they're broken 10 years too soon, thanks to tech, maybe one would argue is irrelevant. I always think the bigger concern is their fairness right now, and that's debatable when it comes to the shoes. So, yeah, I guess whether you're a Luddite or a technologically advanced person, you'll differ on that one.
What about physiologically then, Ross? Is there something that you're seeing over the course of the last week that would not concern you, but would certainly cause you to ask questions about how human evolution has all of a sudden gone from whatever the evolution of man all of a sudden on a vertical axis, and we're starting to see, I don't know, that the man get bigger and bigger and bigger?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like humans have made a breakthrough in the last sort of 18 months, now performing at a level that previous versions didn't do. That might be biased. I mean, that could just be confirmation bias, because I'm looking at Delaine Thompson and Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce and the 400 hurdlers and saying, oh, look at this. But meanwhile, the men's 100 maybe has never been weaker. So the 400 is also probably not going to be as good as it was 5 years ago. So why one event and not the other? Why not all the events? So there's a lot of, call it noise, that affects our ability to interpret this. It would be quite an interesting exercise to really sit down and say, right, what is the 10th best athlete, the 50th best athlete, the average of the top 50? What are they doing now compared to 2-3 years ago? And of course, I guess where you're going with this is that with COVID and lockdown and the sort of global cessation of anti-doping, there's been no disincentive for athletes to dope over the last sort of 12, 18 months. I mean, I think in the quarter that the lockdown was the worst, and so now we're going back to March, April, May last year, I saw stats that many countries in Europe had not conducted a single test in that three-month period. I think the UK anti-doping conducted 5% of its normal testing. Now, the authorities, anti-doping authorities, are always telling us that we can trust the performances because the testing out of competition keeps the athletes clean. Well, if that's true, then the reverse must also be true. So I think there is reason to doubt what we see.
Have you begun to reconsider how quickly the rate of world records that are being broken, or the magnitude with which world records are being broken, have you begun to reconsider if that'll actually start to level off at a sooner rate than you thought, or if we're going to see world records continue to be broken for years and years and years to come?
Well, I thought it had leveled off. I mean, you looked at the world record books 4 or 5 years ago, and you had these two batches. You had all the sprint performances, which were Bolt from the late 2000s, and then you had all the distance records, which went back to the 1990s and early 2000s. And then on the women's side, of course, you go even further back, because the steroid hormones of the 70s and 80s moved women into a place that no natural female can get to. So it looked like they'd already stagnated, and now all of a sudden we've seen them chop down in the middle distances. We've seen them cut down in the long distances. Shoes, is it are the shoes confounding the analysis, or is it all the shoes? No one knows. So it's quite an unstable time. And I mean, I'd hate to predict, but if I say now, it's hard to see it continuing. Then by 2024, it'll have continued, and it will all look foolish, you know. So who knows?
Yeah. And then what about on a purely... So obviously there's a ton of variables involved there. Technology, anti-doping, they're two of the big ones. But what about on a purely physiological level, Ross? Is there still room for evolution, I guess?
Not a great deal. The only way you could see that is if there was some sort of breakthrough or the emergence of a new population. So I think you could go back to the sort of 70s, 80s, and at that stage... sport wasn't truly global. Now sport is truly global. So it's very difficult to imagine that there is a group of humans who have some genetic advantage, whether it's for sprinting or distance running, who haven't yet been exposed, identified, and then pushed through the system to run at the Olympic Games. I mean, I saw this morning, Burkina Faso became the 100th country to win a medal in track and field at the Olympic Games. So this is now a properly global sport. And I can't imagine that there's anything there, you know, like the emergence of a new group of people. So then you've got to say, well, can we do things that much better? My impression is that things like sports science and medicine haven't gotten 2% better in the last 20 years. They get 0.1% better. And we're actually sometimes revisiting things that were out of fashion 20 years ago. So no, I can't think that anything other than tech is going to propel humans faster.
Maybe if we send Dave Brailsford to Burkina Faso and tell him about marginal gains, we might actually see the next big breakthrough, Ross. One other thing we want to chat about, because it's a really fascinating story, are the Namibian sprinters. And Christine Mboma, the 18-year-old sprinter from Namibia, who won a silver medal in the women's 200 metres this week. So herself and Beatrice Masilingi, also from Namibia, they're not allowed to run in the 400 metres, which is their better distance. They are women with differences in sex development, DSD, as it will be more commonly known to people. They can't compete between 400 metres and a mile unless they've taken medicine to lower their testosterone. So just for people who might be coming to this a little bit fresh, Ross, could you remind us of the background as to why they can run the 200 but not the 400?
Yeah, what a convoluted story. Like, I mean, if aliens landed on Earth and saw this, they'd say, this is ridiculous. How can you be legal on a Saturday because you're running a 200 and illegal on a Sunday because you're running the 4? Surely whatever gives you the advantage in the one event is still there for the other, because they're so similar. But the way that it developed is that back in 2016, the sport had a policy for DSDs that covered all the events. And that policy was challenged by an Indian sprinter called Duty Chand, who ran in the 200 in Tokyo. I saw on television the other day. And the court case basically ruled in her favor, but they said to World Athletics that we understand why you have this policy, we get it, but what you need is evidence to support it. So go away, you've got 2 years, and come back to us with evidence. And so off they went, and they produced what really can only be described as very average evidence. They looked for relationships between testosterone and performance at the World Athletics Championships over 2 years, two cycles. And they were only able to find that relationship in the 400 and the 800. In other words, in those two events only, women with high testosterone had a performance advantage compared to women with lowest testosterone. And so when they then came back to the courts to revise their policy, they were constrained because they couldn't cover all the events. They could only cover the events for which they had evidence, poor evidence. And so they ended up in this very clumsy situation where, and I mean, I was at the Court of Arbitration hearing, and their theoretical argument was beautiful. It was so strong, you know, this idea that testosterone gives an unfair biological advantage to people who benefit from it, males, in other words. And if you allow that confounder, androgens, to enter women's sport, then it distorts integrity and fairness for women. And so therefore, women's sport needs to be closed off. I mean, it was a tremendous argument, but then the evidence in support of it was so poor that they couldn't apply this theory to everything. So they ended up capturing the 4 and the 8. They added the 15 because Caster Semenya was running it. And so they said, well, a lot of 800 meter runners also do the 15, but they didn't go the other way. I mean, they should have said that a lot of 400 runners also do the 2, but they didn't. So that loophole allows the Namibians to just say, fine, we'll go win medals in the 200.
And that's a really interesting point you make about Semenya there, that I think you actually did you testify on behalf of Semenya in that hearing because of in the CAS hearing, because of the fact that the evidence in your opinion was so shaky. Like it certainly seems to me that regardless of your viewpoint on this, when it came to Semenya, she was targeted because she was winning, which is not the way you can work something like this.
No, exactly. Like, I mean, and that's the same situation they're going to be in now if they add the 200. And it was almost by design, because when they went away to find their evidence as per the court instruction, the study they did, as I mentioned, they just looked for which events or could they find where testosterone predicted performance. And of course, they found it in the events where the athletes with the high testosterone were. So Semenya was there. They had a couple other 800 meter runners. And so they basically set up, which was a circular argument. So I don't think, I mean, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt here, but I don't think they targeted Semenya, but they certainly designed a process that was going to isolate and identify her for regulation. So now, I mean, I don't know if you've got this game where you go to the fairground and you hit the crocodile as it pops its head out the hole. That's what they're playing now, because now you're going to have these. And this Mboma, who won silver in the 200, her first 100 meters is so poor that if she could fix that, she'd win the gold and she could probably break the world record. So they're going to be faced with the same thing. And then they're going to add the 200 and people will say, well, you just don't want these black African women to win. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah. Where does it leave these athletes if you do add the 200? They just stop competing, some of the greatest athletes that we've seen.
Sorry, I missed the first part of that.
Just that if we add the 200, then where does it leave these athletes? You know, do we just stop seeing these athletes competing, like some of the best athletes we've seen?
Yeah, I mean, if you add the 200, then they've got to go to the 100, or they'll run the 5,000. Okay, they're not going to go up there. But, I mean, one of the other DSD athletes, Francine Nyansaba, went up. She ran the 5,000. So, yeah, they've created this weird paradox that allows athletes to just kind of move around and try and escape the regulations. And again, I mean, I testified at the case about the evidence, but the principle is sound. You have to protect women's sport against the male biological advantages, but the way it's been done is just so damaging to the person who's covered by it. It's a real shame.
You mentioned there about Mboma's run, and if she managed to get the first 100 nailed, she would have been a gold medalist winner. And thankfully, we've got Seb Coe, who's given his reaction to the race. He says it was pretty observable that the last 30 or 40 metres were impactful. And actually, I think that vindicated the decision about the 400 metres. If you were finishing a 200 like that, you extend the runway. That, in a way, supports the judgment that was made. I presume that went down very well in the scientist community, Ross.
I saw that quote. I mean, it's... You'll always manage to find a way to distort something into something else. I mean, for that is called like silver lining thinking, if you've ever seen it, you know, or glass half full. Crazy theory. I mean, yeah. Honestly, I'm speechless to even respond to it. It's just a bizarre defense that he's offering. I mean, truth is, if she improves her start, this was her first major competition at 200. I think she came in a second slower than she ended up running 3 races later. So by the end of the season, she'll be winning, and by next year she might be breaking the record. So. I mean, then what would you say then?
I want to go back to what Aisling said there, because we're kind of tight on time, and it's a really interesting question about where that leaves athletes in these positions. So more from Seb Coe, he kind of spoke about the option of an open category in the future, a restricted biological female category. He says, I don't think that's where most of my council are at the moment, but this is a debate. I've heard coaches and people who are interested in the sport and more broadly from the sport have discussed that. Is that a realistic avenue at some point in the future, Ross?
It's theoretical in nature. It's very difficult to implement in real life. I mean, when World Rugby sat down to discuss its transgender policy, we ended at the same point where we said, all right, men's rugby is the open category. Anyone can play it. But we need to have adjacent to men's rugby, we need to have a closed category. And what are we closing it against? The biological effects of testosterone. So then sport changes from having men's and women's to having open and then protected. But the thing is, ultimately, it's just renaming the same category. And so when that was presented and discussed with the transgender community, they rejected it on that basis. And that's why it'll probably not work there either. But in theory, that's what men's and women's sports categories do. It's just putting a different name to them and then hoping to convince people that somehow that makes it palatable to those who don't want it.
There may be a very short answer to this question, Ross, but is there a world in which you can see an organisation like World Athletics finding some sort of satisfying answer to the debate between inclusion and diversity and fairness?
If satisfying means that both sides are happy, then absolutely not, unfortunately. If satisfying means that the majority are happy, then of course. And if satisfying means that the minority is happy, then they can do it. But the point is that they have to choose. You know, the sports are going to have to make a decision around which one they value. Do they value the fairness or do they value inclusion? Because at the moment, I can't see that there's a way to achieve both at the same time.
And is your sense that inclusion is higher up on the priority list for World Athletics specifically at the moment? Or have they fudged it so badly at this point that it's muddied the waters where you don't actually know which is the higher priority?
No, I think their priority at the moment is fairness, because that's why they've taken the approach that they did in the Semenya thing, and they did do it badly, to be fair, or to be honest about it. The debate really is whether the fix, you know, they ask these athletes, you mentioned it, they ask these athletes to lower their testosterone levels and then they can compete. They do the same thing with trans women. So they're trying to facilitate inclusion and fairness at the same time. There's no evidence that fix works. And so the ball is back in their court now, and it's back in the IOC's court to say, all right, we had this idea and it was going to work for fairness and inclusion. It clearly doesn't. So now, again, we have to choose. And then I suspect that they will be pressurized into weighting inclusion more than fairness. But that remains to be seen.
It's really interesting. We could obviously go on for hours here, and I would encourage people to go to the Real Science of Sport podcast and listen to Ross talk about it for a more in-depth conversation about it, for sure. Before I let you go, Ross, I mean, your beloved Springboks this weekend, are they going to get the job done?
Yeah, I think so. I think the momentum is with the team. The loss of three players, especially Fafter Clark, is a big deal. I think that'll compromise defensively what we are able to do, but I suspect that we will get it done.
Come for the athletics analysis, stay for the rugby prediction. Professor Ross Tucker, thanks a million.
Thanks, guys. Ciao.
Cheers. And as I say, you can follow him at Science of Sport on Twitter as well.
The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
Yes, Dublin aren't in great form, but they're bored out in their mind. Paul Mannion and Jack McCaffrey aren't playing, yes, because of the stress and the strain, but they're a bit bored.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.